Hello everybody, this is Salil Tripathi from the Institute for Human Rights and Business in London, and I'm talking to Doug Castle, who teaches at the University of Notre Dame in the law faculty and is an expert on the field of international law and business and human rights. The theme for us this year, as we explore the top 10, as we know, as we've been talking in the past few days, is about the issue of remedy and the elusive nature of remedy. Doug, you paid a lot of attention to and focus on the whole issue of the new treaty. Can you tell us your experience about that entire process and why it is necessary?
Well, the UN guiding principles, in my judgment, have made some headway in terms of clarifying and reinforcing state obligations under Pillar 1 to protect human rights. And they've made some advances in terms of clarifying and establishing the business responsibility to respect human rights under Pillar 2. But in regard to the third and final pillar, Pillar 3, access to justice and the right to a remedy, UN guiding principles and other such initiatives have been, in my judgment, to date, a resounding I think that is a large part of the reason why there is such a worldwide movement among NGOs to push for a treaty or other legally binding instrument to regulate business and human rights. Because at the moment, in those instances where business is involved in violations of human rights, it's almost impossible for most victims in almost all countries of the world, realistically, to have access to justice and effective remedies.
But what it means is that we are in a situation where the state failure to prosecute in all parts of the world is the reason why we're crying out for a treaty, isn't it? That something happens in Nigeria is not justiciable there. It's very hard for people to get justice in Nigeria against a multinational company. And the home state typically doesn't recognize the claim because it feels the offense did not occur in its jurisdiction. And therefore, there is this gap. To what extent can this problem be solved by focusing more on home state responsibilities? The reason I ask this is because getting any treaty signed and ratified and negotiated is a very long process.
It certainly is a long process, a difficult process, and one whose outcome is uncertain at best. The idea of solving the problem is, I think, an impossible dream. The goal instead should be to try to improve the situation as much as we can. But guaranteeing justice across the board for victims of human rights violations, or indeed for victims of any other legal wrongs, is something that the justice systems of the world are not yet and probably never will be capable of achieving. If you'll permit a digression here, that is one reason why the whole question of prevention is so important. There are many instances where a violation takes place that no matter what jurisdiction, no matter what cause of action, no matter what formal legal remedy may be granted, there is simply no way to undo the harm that has been done to human emotions, human lives, and human relationships. And then, assuming that we can actually get people into court, we have to face the problems of the obstacles and the barriers and the high costs of any form of litigation. Some listeners may recall the statement, I believe, that was attributed to Dr. Johnson, maybe I'm wrong in the attribution, who said he was only ruined by a lawsuit twice, once when he lost and once when he won. So we need to find ways that are not just theoretically formally available, but are practical, accessible, and affordable. What the treaty can do in regard to home state jurisdiction is to impose an obligation which most states do not yet accept to police the activities in effect of their own multinational corporations by allowing those corporations to be sued in their home capitals for actions which they either are directly involved in overseas or through their subsidiaries are involved in overseas. In the European Union, under the Brussels Regulation, There is home state jurisdiction over the parent corporation, but home state jurisdiction over the foreign subsidiary depends on whether you have a cause of action against the home state corporation in its home state, and that becomes very tricky as a matter of law. But outside the European Union, it is not firmly established in most countries that jurisdiction in the home country is available against a home state company. That's certainly not the case in the United States, Canada, Australia, and many other common law jurisdictions where the doctrine of forum non convenience continues to apply, namely that a court having received a lawsuit in the company's home state will, at the request of either party, but normally it's the company, decide to try to remove the lawsuit to the foreign jurisdiction where the wrong was actually committed on the ground. And that doctrine means, number one, that many lawsuits will be removed from the home state jurisdiction. And number two, even when they're not removed, it adds what is often a lengthy and very expensive element to the litigation before you even get to the merits of the case. A treaty could effectively require states parties to the treaty not to invoke forum non-convenience and to allow home state jurisdiction.
Right, and this would be particularly useful for incidents such as the Bhopal gas disaster, of course, which has been a pending issue since 1984. And there are other cases also where people have been seeking justice for a very long time. But reflecting just on that for a moment, whether it is the Bhopal case or the struggles of the Ogoni people against oil companies in Niger Delta, what we are talking about are instances of grave abuses. So do you think that the project can be more realistic if the remedies being sought are for such grave abuses? And if so, how do we define them?
Well, the treaty, in my view, should cover all violations of human rights recognized under international human rights law. But the treaty will have different parts, and one of those parts would be the part that deals with civil remedies, that is, the ability of a victim to file a lawsuit against the company that is allegedly responsible for a violation and to obtain some form of redress, which most often would involve monetary compensation, although it could go beyond that. One way to do that in the treaty is not to limit it to the possibility of a civil remedy to the most serious violations. The argument for not limiting it is that way one avoids the difficult question, which would itself give rise to aspects of lengthy litigation, of trying to define which is a serious violation and which is not. And by covering all violations, that doesn't mean that there would be lawsuits filed over trivial matters, because lawsuits are so expensive to bring, and there are so few lawyers and law firms in the world prepared to bring them, that it would be very difficult to find a lawyer or a law firm or a victim willing to undertake the time and cost of bringing a lawsuit, which in many cases on an international basis can run just in terms of out-of-pocket costs for witnesses and translation and investigation easily in excess of 100,000 British pounds. People are not going to file lawsuits like that over trivial matters.
Right.
So ironically, the very cost of litigation will serve as an adequate filter to ensure that cases are brought only for very important human rights violations without having to legally exclude any human rights violations from civil remedies. Now, that's my particular view. We are, of course, very early in the stage of drafting the treaty. To date, we have only a set of vaguely defined elements presented by the lead sponsor of the treaty, Ecuador, in late September or early October. Many things could happen during a process of negotiation that might end up narrowing or specifying the kinds of human rights violations for which civil damages might be sought. But at least at this stage of the process, my view is that we should keep it wide open and that will not risk any harm for the reason I've stated. And I should add, when I referred to Ecuador's vaguely defined elements, I don't mean that as a criticism. I think at the outset of a negotiation process, vagueness is a virtue because it opens the door to future specification by way of negotiation, rather than closing the door by taking excessively particular positions right at the outset.
I have two questions. One is procedural and one is substantive before we end. The procedural one is, because you mentioned about the lengthy process involved of negotiation, what would be your estimate? And this is, of course, a ballpark estimate, but if a treaty were to happen, would it happen in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years?
As the American folk singer Lee Hayes once said, predictions are difficult to make, especially about the future.
Right.
There's a tremendous range of possible timelines for the treaty. One of them is that the treaty process may come to a crashing end as early as February or March of next year, 2018. The reason for that is that some countries, including the United States and Australia, took the position at the last working group meeting in October that a new UN Human Rights Council resolution is needed to continue the work of the open-ended working group on the treaty beyond the three meetings initially specified in the 2014 resolution that launched this process. If they prevail before the Human Rights Council in insisting on a new resolution, and a new resolution fails to gather a sufficient number of votes, that could spell the end of the UN treaty-making process.
Right.
On the other hand, if they do not succeed in that, and the position of the UN staff is that the resolution establishing the open-ended working group is indeed open-ended and has no end date. It did refer to the first three meetings, but those are not conclusive to the process. Then the likelihood is that the Ecuadorians will present the draft text of a treaty somewhere in mid-2018, and there will be another meeting of the working group probably in the fall of 2018. And that will be the first meeting in which the states' parties will have before them an actual draft text of a treaty to debate. If that scenario holds, my guess is that it would then take at least 2 years to reach agreement on the text of a treaty at the UN. And once that happens, the treaty would have to go to each of the states for potential ratification. And one key issue will be, what is the minimum number of states required to join the treaty in order for it to go into force and effect? That could easily take an additional 2 to 5 years. And all of what I've just described is a somewhat optimistic scenario. It could take longer.
Right. So optimistically, 7 to 9 years, something like that. That's useful to know. The other is a substantive one, which is that most of the conversation we've had today has talked about multinationals in another country. But obviously, you know, human rights abuses can occur with home companies as well and non-multinational companies as well. And sometimes those are more egregious and more widespread, and they just never get to see the light of the day, except by the local human rights groups and so on. I mean, this is a question more for the activist groups and so on. But how do we ensure that the system is such that an abuse, no matter committed by a multinational or a local company, will have a remedy either internationally or locally? Easier to say than do it. Can the treaty take that into account?
It can in theory, but it is a point of enormous controversy. It may be the single most controversial point in the whole treaty debate, although there's some others as well. So far, there are three positions. One position is that staked out very firmly by South Africa and a number of other countries, that the treaty must address only the violations committed by transnational corporations, that the whole purpose of a treaty is to fill the gaps in existing national laws, and each country has national laws to regulate its own companies. A second position is that of the European Union and a number of other states, which is that, as you said, human rights violations can be committed by companies, whether they are transnational or not, and therefore the treaty must cover all corporations, including local corporations, and that to exclude local corporations would leave an enormous gap, both in injustice as well as introduce an element of discrimination among companies that are otherwise not distinguishable in a meaningful way. A third position, which Ecuador has attempted to propose as apparently as a sort of a compromise in the draft elements paper that is currently being discussed, is to say that corporations are covered whenever their activities have a transnational aspect. So the issue would not be whether a company is transnational or local, but rather whether the activities of that company are transnational in character for purposes of coverage by the treaty. So you might have a local company, but if that local company happens to sell its product to a foreign buyer, conceivably that might qualify as business activity of a transnational character. That phrase, like many others in the elements, has yet to be defined, and it could be defined narrowly to exclude, for example, selling to a foreign buyer, or broadly to include it. But it does seem to me that that proposal by Ecuador offers at least a potential way to get through the impasse between the positions of South Africa and the European Union. But all of that will continue to be the subject of debate.
Yeah, and it'll be a fascinating debate. Thank you so much, Doug, and all the best with your work.
My pleasure, Salil, and congratulations to the ongoing work of the IHRB.